All right, Ashanti, you're on next, and that gives Lynn a whole chunk of time to, like, get comfy and be the next speaker after you. Only the techies with the mics get to say that. Should he come here? Come here, man.
Okay. Hey, I'm nervous. I'm happy to be here in my nervousness. I don't know why I'm here at this particular house, because this is like a second home to me. But I'm really excited about that Matt has two books now. And the one that's a collective effort, I'm really happy that and honored that I was a part of it. So I want to say, you know, to Matt, I mean, I thank you so much for all the work that you do with the support of this family that I'm so close to. Because all the years that even I myself spent in prison, I didn't know them, but we always knew that there was staunch supporters from other communities, besides the black communities, besides the Latino communities, you know, and then to come out and actually begin to meet people, and especially, you know, people that just take you right into their home, you know, it keeps me optimistic, you know, because I know that from my background, coming out of a really staunch nationalist movement, did not really want to have too much to do with white folks. You know, Panther Party helped me to evolve, to see that we was in solidarity with people struggling from all kind of different communities, places, spaces, experiences, desires for something better. And so for me, like, to be here now, and it's like, hey, this is what this is all about. These gatherings like these in houses, you know, not necessarily in the real formal popular places, but this is where the real revolutionary stuff for me happens. This is where it really counts. The book, Let Freedom Ring, 900 and something pages, is just amazing. But I know it's just the tip of what else is downstairs in the basement, here on this floor, and on every other floor in this house. But they all have this connection around people's struggles, you know? And to be able to put it in a book, like even right now, we're using it. And like when Matt talked about this, our effort now to get into the UN, to get our stories into the UN, our stories told. Whether it's through the issue of political prisoners or whether it's for the independence of Puerto Rico, you know, like, for generations we've been trying to do this. I remember reading the words of Paul Robeson and others who are William Patterson, "We charge genocide. Let's take it to the international arena." Malcolm X, Robert Williams, and others, to get our stories into the international arena. And it just seems like now we may well be right on the edge of doing this. And if they want documentation, they can go to the book, Let Freedom Ring. You know, simple, Let Freedom Ring. You know, and I love that also, because it just explains what we're all in this for, that we don't have to have a lot of fancy words to describe the freedom that we want. Just let freedom ring. The same thing that we said in the 50s and 60s, we want freedom now. And it just meant that we were simple people that wanted decent, dignified lives, able to control our destinies, not abuse the earth and the resources. And there it is. You know, we don't have to fight over ideological stuff. All of those political prisoners and prisoners of war come from those movements that basically put out the same visions, the same dreams, even if they had their own particular artistic forms, whether it was independence for Puerto Rico, sovereignty for the indigenous nations, or when black folks said, we want a liberation of our people, black nation, whatever. we had this dream. We were willing to take risks. I think for me, the importance of this book is that it can be used internationally and on the ground. I can see us using that, as we already are, to get into the marinas now, but I can see it even more importantly for these young folks who are just getting interested in these movements, who are just starting to develop a critical perspective on what's going on and are thinking about ways to get involved. What better way to do it through connecting with political prisoners and prisoners of war, knowing about those who took certain risks from back in the 60s and the 70s to change this world. We're willing to take risks that they knew put their lives on the line. And many of us know that it was not only us putting our lives, that some of those, our comrades, did not make it because they fell. Fell to death, physical, or fell to the death of their spirits, because that's how terrible the repression was. I know comrades who did not recover, who maybe came into the Panther Party, alcoholics, drug addicts, and were able to recover their lives. But after the destruction of our movements from the counterintelligence program, fell back into what they used to do before. And some who never maybe used drugs or alcohol, because of the repression and because of what it did to the spirit, just lost it. Maybe didn't die physically, but some to this day just like will never believe again in the possibility of changing this world. The political prisoners, on the other hand, are living in dungeons, which sometimes we could look at as caskets. The places are so small. 5 years go by, 10, 15, 20, up to 40. They live still in the same circumstances, yet their spirits are not broken. We come in to see them through visits. We go through all of our ups and downs of here, trying to pay bills, raise kids, deal with the madness. Sometimes they're not always in the most robust of spirits going into the prisons. Yet we're going to come out revved, because they have revved us up. And it's amazing what that says about the human spirit. It's amazing what it says, you know. So when we tried to do this, when we tried to keep this political prisoner and prisoner of war movement going, we are asking people not just to get involved because they're political prisoners, prisoners of war being treated bad, but get involved because it is recapturing that human spirit. It is also recapturing the ability to dream about something different that they stand for concretely, and they are not willing to give up. It is so important. The passing recently of Bashir Hamid hit a lot of us hard. Bashir was one who had said to me on visits that he could come to terms with dying in prison as long as he knew that we were carrying on the movements on the streets. And he just wanted to be connected, just keep him connected, let him be a part of that. And when he first said that to me, that hit me hard, because when I was myself inside, we made a commitment to each other that when one got out, we would help to get the others out. However, you know, whether it was through legal measures, whatever. And I got out mid to late 80s. And I've been out pretty much ever since. But every day they are on my mind that they're still in and I'm still out. That's heavy. It's a heavy, heavy, heavy burden. But the only thing that allows me to deal with it is that I keep meeting people who want to do this work around them and around that bigger picture of all the general movements that are trying to make this world better. It keeps me going. It keeps me going. just even today, you know, like coming here today, I seen all the people come in, and a lot of people from the neighborhood. I mean, I was here, living here, not too long ago, briefly, while I got flooded out of my nice apartment in Far Rockaway. But, and seeing people coming with their kids, and I just met John Henry. Yes. You know, John Henry, can you, I'm like, the name itself, it's like, I thought of the song, John Henry, you know, was a man with a hammer in his hand. I'm like, this little boy gonna come into a free world. Free world. It's the same thing I said, and at the same age that when my daughter was born, my daughter was the same age that he is now, that I went totally underground. Same reason, same optimism that I had then, I have now. Because of him and the children like him, we have got to carry this on, and we have got to be so optimistic about it. The same way that Bashir was, the same way that Noah was. I'm sure the same way that Merle Africa was. You know, it's like, we can do this, because they, inside them prisons under the worst conditions, somehow keep that spirit alive. Why can't we? You know, we are a part of them and they are a part of us. You know, the work around these political prisoners is not just to get them out. It is for us to stay so fully alive that we know that whatever we set our minds to as movements who represents different issues, different communities, that whatever we put our minds to and we say we can do, we want to do, we will do. The same spirit and even better than the 60s. We can let the 60s rest, in a sense. We can bury that part. We can do whatever ritual we got to do. But the struggles that we're involved with today, with political prisoners like really on the top of our agendas, we can make revolution happen again within this empire. We can do it in a way that can bring our political prisoners and prisoners of war home. And for me, they got to be brought home with dignity. Because for me, that means that they're not going to be forced into a situation. They got to compromise their values and their convictions in order to get out on parole. But they'll get out. We'll bring them out the same way that Mandela and others have gotten out, because of the power of our movements, rejuvenating, recapturing that spirit, you know. And it's what for me these political prisoners represent. They have that. They have that. And they just want us to just carry it. Just carry it. And I'm of the firm belief that we can do it. I work with the Anarchist Black Cross and others. And they are ready to carry stuff on. I work with the young folks from the new Black Panther Party. They are ready to carry this work on. I work with the young folks from the Malcolm X grassroots movement. They are ready to carry this work on. And I'm still meeting people and meeting people. Therefore, I'm convinced, with beyond a shadow of a doubt, that we can win. We can win because we have people like them inside who represent the best of our humanity. Thank you.
And without further ado, like Ashanti, we're very honored and pleased to have Lynn Stewart here.
Yes.
And Lynn, take it away.
Happy to be here. Drove about 370 miles today to get down here because I couldn't miss the coming out of this great book, which I think will be of great use to us in our work and also of great use to us, you know, to pick up and get re-inspired. I mean, I just opened the book and there's beautiful Marilyn Buck looking out at me. I mean, you know that it is true. I think, as Ashanti said, you know, you're out here fighting everything. You're worrying about this and worrying about that, and you go in to visit somebody and you come out invigorated by that visit, by their spirit, by what they are all about. And I thought to myself, one of our major jobs, it seems to me, besides the UN, besides everything else, is creating the aura of hero and heroine around the political prisoners. These are true heroes, and we've let the media turn them into monsters. And that is one reason why it is harder to do the work we want to do, which is to get them out and to build a movement. I think if people understood that our children's hero, and when you're in this house, as Dolphy, my friend, was just saying, this house is full of children's toys and books and everything, you realize that the impression on children and the impression on all of us must be one where we understand that Herman Bell and Jaleel are not the monsters of the media and the PBA, but really are brave men that sacrificed their lives at this point to be part of a movement to change things, to bring about change, real change. And they understood that it couldn't only be from petitioning the higher-ups in government. It had to come from the bottom, and it had to come with some teeth in it. So that said, I was remarking on the fact that, today the community seems so bound up in adoring Obama that nobody can say a bad word about him, that the left has had meetings. How do we go about talking to our black friends about Obama? To me, it points out the sharp distinction between the political prisoners and Obama. Obama, if you go back to the days of slavery, he was the guy that lived in the biggest slave cabin, who went to the master and told him what was going on down in the quarters. He's the guy who did what master wanted and had a safe and sure peace place. The sadness is that so many people aspire to be that. That's what they want to be. They want to be in that safe and secure position rather than aspiring to be like the warriors, rather than aspiring to be the David Gilbert or others who have risked so much and who were so clear on the reasons why they were doing so. So as a result, we have Obama calling Bill Ayer's despicable acts of the Weather Underground, and really nobody contradicting that and saying, how dare you, the true despicable acts were McCain's bombing innocent civilians in Hanoi. That's despicable. What the Weather Underground did, what the BLA did, what the Black Panther Party did, were strikes for liberty. And we can win this thing. Sunday night at the New School, the Prime Minister of Nepal, now retired from being a guerrilla leader, will be speaking. Nepal had a long and violent Maoist insurrection, and they won, big. The king is gone. They had elections. The Maoist party was elected. We don't get too much of this in the press. They don't like this. They like Somalia and Darfur and misery on top of misery. But you don't hear much about Nepal. It's a little country, granted. Nice mountains. But he will be speaking at the New School on Sunday night. I'm certainly going to be there. He was called, what was his name when he was underground? It was something like... some wonderful militant go-get-em name. And as I say, other revolutions they have fought and they have won. I was never happier at my 69th birthday 2 weeks ago than my... yes, for that reason, too. When my 22-year-old granddaughter came in and said, Grandma, I saw the movie Che. She said, it's 4 hours long, and it was so wonderful, and it made me think so much that when I was going home on the train, I didn't even turn on my iPod or read. She said, it was just the best movie ever. So we got her to sign up for this movement. We got all these folks that can be moved by a movie like that, where they see true revolutionaries with great acts of courage, And I think this book will help us to portray that to people, as well as give us materials that can be used in many, many ways to forward the movement. So we're here to get organized. We're here to get a book. I know Matt said I had to come over and get one because he wasn't going to carry this tome around. But even if you can just carry it, it's probably good for us to carry it around, you know?
If you get two, then it's actually balanced.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We are getting two, but I'm not going to carry them around. But I will say, you know, and there is more to come yet, and I think also encouraging people who are in jail. I had my grandson Ernesto was doing a program on the first people in, you know, to fly in space. So I'm trying to think of the name of the program. I'm thinking of the program that it was, you know, the earliest one that was, they were putting monkeys and they would orbit and then they finally got a couple of people up there. Well, I wonder how many people in this room know that Sundiata Okoli was part of that program. He was hired right out of college, right out of the University of Oklahoma, to be in this top secret, very, very important program because he was so brilliant mathematically. So I said to my grandson, I said, I don't know anything about anything scientific, but I have a friend. And if you write to him, I'm sure he'll write back to you and tell you about his experiences. Well, I want you to know that Sundiata wrote back the most extraordinary letter with pictures showing things, with his whole experience being part of this, how they worked, what was done. And then he ended it by saying, but you know, I left, I think it was White Sands, New Mexico, for a trip to Harlem. He said, and when I got to Harlem, I knew I was never going back to White Sands. That the movement was more important than anything. And he joined the movement, and he, of course, was with Asada on the New Jersey Turnpike on that most miserable day. But Sundiata is now right up at Otisville. Not a long trip for anybody. And he is another one of these remarkable men who sacrificed so much and to whom we owe so much, and yet who don't demand from us. All they ask is that we carry on the struggle. And so I know that's what we intend to do. I'm very hopeful. One of my many tasks on my to-do list, which is very long, but one of the things I'd love to do is just get this little story that Sundiata wrote and illustrated for my grandson and get that published for everyone's grandson and everyone's son, because here is this remarkable man. And where is he today, and why don't we get him out, is the question, my grand. Why don't you get him out? And I said, we're trying, Ernesto. We are definitely trying. So I leave you with that, and I say to you, I'm very happy to be here. I was very happy to write the afterword. I was told to make it fiery, so I tried, and that I can do, as I said. Mr. Dolphy, yes.
Yeah. Interested in what's happening with your case presently.
Oh, okay. I didn't bring him to feed me this question, I swear to you. But people say to me, you don't have a talk about...
No, he just wrote it earlier. It would have gotten...
It would have gotten... Okay. What is happening with my case is nothing. It is sitting there in the laps of these judges, these princes of the court. And when they decide to decide it, they'll decide it. We know there's got to be some or a lot of discussion going on because one of the three judges on my appeal from my trial is the cousin of George Bush. He couldn't get over such a light sentence, 28 months, you know, and kept going on and on about that. And no question that he will fall right in line on all the substantive issues like the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth, the Sixth, because he appeared to be at the oral argument very much like the rest of the family, arrogant and fairly stupid. Because no matter how many times the lawyers told him, But, Judge, you know, that's not this case. We don't have those facts in this case. He just went on like he never heard a word they said. Sort of like WMD, you know. Anyway, so we know he must be fighting, maybe, with the other two judges, one of whom seems to be a good man, an ex-dean of Yale Law School, a person whose name ends with a vowel, so you know he probably wasn't going to any skull and bones meetings. And the third, Judge Sack, is he's good and bad, I think. I really, nobody knows where to place him. But it's all reading tea leaves. We have no idea what they'll do. We were gladdened by a recent decision where they said that in the case of two Yemeni men, one of whom sold ice cream on Court Street, so meanwhile funneling $40 million to Osama, according to the government. Guess he sold ice cream just for the hell of it, you know? Could have skimmed a little there and not had to sell ice cream, but what do I know? Anyway, they went to trial in front of a judge named Sterling Johnson, renowned of special narcotics as a prosecutor. And they lost, and he gave them not the 30 years that the government wanted. He gave them each 75 years. And the court recently reversed and said the inflammatory material that was placed in front of the jury was so gross that it requires a new trial. It should never have been there. It skewed the results. They talked about a bomb being placed by Hamas in Israel, and they brought in survivors of this blast to testify about it. And they also talked about Osama bin Laden's training camps with graphic, the guy was on the stand for days, just detailing every inch of this training camp, where the connection to the case was so tenuous. Now, in our case, we had, of course, the Luxor massacre in Egypt, which occurred, I think, at least 5 years before the conspiracy was supposed to have even begun. And we also had Osama bin Laden every place in great, big, huge pictures for the jury. I mean, they had him on a screen that's probably as big as this whole wall. And then the jury had screens, television screens, where they saw it. And they introduced that or other scurrilous evidence so often that the judge on 700 occasions told the jury, this is not offered as evidence against Lynn Stewart. This is only evidence of state of mind of the third co-defendant. It's not offered for the truth. But yet, there he was. I mean, and we're talking about a jury that not a mile from the World Trade Center, each of whom, as we all do, had their own story from 9/11, and who have been told that bin Laden had no part at all in the case, which indeed he did not have. But so that may help us on appeal here. Of course, I'm my heart of hearts, I hope they will reverse on some of the more substantive. It will be nice to get back the attorney-client privilege, which was taken away from us in this case. It will be nice to get back the right to be secure when you're talking to your client on the phone and the government is listening in. There's just so much. I also realize more and more that my client, Sheikh Omar, was being tortured, that even though we didn't realize it, and that's Ramsey, myself, and Abdin Jabara, because we weren't aware of what sensory deprivation does to people. We weren't aware of what solitary confinement does to people. And here he was, basically not allowed to even talk to the guards, much less have a visit, much less see anybody but his lawyers, who saw him maybe once every 3 or 4 months. So I just came from a Lawyers Guild convention in which the ACLU had a session on prison conditions, and one of the things, one of their handouts was how to survive in solitary confinement, a very, very, very telling piece of literature. So there's all kinds of things in the case, and we're just waiting and waiting. It's kind of crazy making, but we don't think about it most of the time. We just keep on keeping on, and I'm very happy not to be a political prisoner. Frees me to help all those others.
So I am pleased and honored to introduce my partner in life and political things, who is has been the editor of two books, and now we have one of the writers coming in, Sylvia. And I'm going to start by introducing Matt, who's going to explain the context of the evening. The two books are here. And I want to thank you guys all for coming. So Matt Meyer, who has been an Africanist, a teacher. I met him the first day I met him, he walked into the class we were taking in teacher training and smiled and said, "A kid just threw a desk at me." So he's taught all over Brooklyn in many different situations, and he's also traveled all over different parts of Africa and Central America, and worked diligently in the cause of peace and justice.
He wouldn't be here if it wasn't for me.
Oh, and so I have to introduce his mother, Marilyn Meyer. Very important. Very important.
There was a partner involved also.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. It's a little... it's a little daunting to have, but also very thrilling to have an event, introduced by my partner, and then she's interrupted by my mom, and then my baby girl is right there. So it's really a pleasure to have this first welcoming and release of both of these books in New York City, here in Brooklyn, and here amongst neighbors and friends and comrades. So. Thank you, neighbors and friends and comrades, for being here. They'll be, more public and different types of book events for both of these books, separate, maybe even a couple together, as the weeks go on, which we'll tell you about more if you want. Let me know, and you'll get on all the lists if you're not already on all the various e-lists. But it's great to be here, and it's great to be here surrounded by not only... my community, this community we live and work in together, but also people who contributed to making both of these books possible. One of them has essentially no writing from me in it, the other quite a bit of writing, but being an editor of books, I've found now that they're out, to be quite a fun endeavor. The books before this that I wrote or co-wrote were... quite a bit more complicated, and though their release was a little more like some male equivalent of childbearing, bringing together the community in writing was a labor of love. So I think we're going to focus most conversation tonight and Resistance in Brooklyn, the collective that really pushed me to edit Let Freedom Ring, was most involved in the production of that book, and the two people who we've asked to also speak tonight, Ashanti Alston and Lynn Stewart, who will hopefully be here momentarily, will focus on that one. But I'm going to talk in this introduction a little bit about both books and how they come together for me politically as well as personally. There is something, I think, very real and poignant as we build the struggle at this point forward about those resonating words from decades previous, the personal is political. And there really is no way for me to separate those realities in my own production of thought and production of political work. So, for example, when I think about my own story and my own history...
Hi.
I can't help but think of my early years as a 17, 18-year-old political activist and my mentors, and the key ones at that period were folks who I reference in these books and in my work, Mauna Koyate, Bill Sutherland, and Luis Nieves Falcón. And it's worth not only honoring them, Mauna, who's now passed, Bill, who is a couple of blocks away in a rehabilitation, physical rehabilitation center following a hospitalization. Nieves Falcón also getting up there in years and having a difficult time because their revolutionary spirit and action and their political work set for me a trajectory that understood a nexus between national liberation and between political imprisonment. And to me, that's a natural nexus that's understood pretty deeply and pretty pretty sharply, pretty concretely throughout the so-called Third World, throughout the Global South, and throughout certainly the African liberation movements. It's not something I think we think of here too much. And I think many of us, including Ashanti and Lynn, are working to make sure that that doesn't happen and that we understand the international context of the human rights struggles here at home, here in the U.S. So, you know, I'll reference Bill, especially, who this book, Seeds of New Hope, is dedicated to, a Pan-Africanist who moved to what was then Gold Coast in 1953, by saying people think of him as this great bridge between African and African-American, black New African populations. People don't necessarily think of him in his other significant and in some ways at least chronologically primary endeavor. People don't think of him as a jailbird. He started out, or a major feature of his early political work, was as a U.S. political prisoner, as a conscientious objector to World War II. And so in learning about him and in learning who this man was and then in learning from him, part and parcel of that education was about what it meant to put one's life on the line, to go to jail for one's beliefs here at home before he ever began the substantive and intense work around national liberation. So, and supporting national liberation struggles in Africa. So that's just a reference point, and I guess the thing I'll say about this book, and then we'll have more in conversation, is that this book comes together as a series of conferences and journal conversations between a number of us on the questions of war and peace on the African continent, and what we see, what many of us see as an inaccurate, you know, a grossly inaccurate, and that's putting it kindly, view of the continent as this place full of hopelessness and horror and war, when in fact the seeds of hope, not just for Africa itself, but for all of humanity, lie in, I think many of us feel, the struggles that are for a new liberation that are going on right now. So it's great to have Sylvia Federici in the room, one of the contributors to this book. And, you know, there are several others who are on and about New York, or will be in New York when we do more formal launching of this book by itself. This book is also the first volume of a two-volume piece. The second one, Seeds Bearing Fruit, Pan-Africanist Peace Action for the 21st Century, will look at the same question, but from a grassroots activist perspective. So these essays tend to be a little bit more theoretical in nature and a little bit more regional in nature. So we have overviews of the continent as a whole, or Pan-Africanism, or regions within the continent, whereas in the second book there'll be many more individual case studies that look at particular projects going on right now that don't have the same character of the national liberation movements. They're not about state power, but do have as much to say about liberation as anything that we've seen yet. So I'll pass on now just to say about Let Freedom Ring that without Meg, whose idea it was initially to somehow lose me as a partner for a year so I could, you know, go into the basement and dig out what ends up becoming 914 pages of a book. Even more than Meg, if not for Betsy, who's actually read the entire book, I'm not even sure I have, but I know Betsy has read the entire book like twice. Or three times. Okay, she's confessing not to read the index, but I suggest she probably read parts of the index. If not for Bobby, who came in later and saved us from making some significant mistakes. Elspeth, who not only provided her own graphics, but, you know, from her graphic collection. And last but certainly not least, Ashanti for providing political leadership at the front end of the book. And afterward, at the back end, literally speaking, this book is really a collective effort. So that's a joy, and it's a joy that we, I think, embarked upon because we felt like pieces of our recent history, in terms of work around political prisoners and work to free them, was being lost. Lost to our own movement's lack of understanding about the need to cling on to our campaigns and to look critically at how those campaigns did some good things and also made some mistakes. So this book is not a history book and it's not an analysis, it's a resource guide. And it's a resource guide essentially, you know, as the subtitle says, where documents from those struggles are collected for people to look at. Now, obviously, there is analysis just in choosing documents. Even a 914-page book could be much bigger if one attempts to be comprehensive. This is not. So we selected documents that we thought pointed some directions towards ways in which we think things need to go, and there is some commentary throughout the book about that. But more than anything, I think this book is hoping to give the movements of today and tomorrow some understanding of the last 25 years, that particular chunk of time, we don't go back further than that, but 25 years of work around political prisoners, what has been done, what doesn't need to be repeated, and what can be built upon. Two more things, and then I'm going to pass it over to Ashanti. First, to say that the work of the last month around the 10th anniversary of critical resistance, prison abolition movement that was celebrated in a conference in California, and Jericho 10, the 10th anniversary of the organization built to work for amnesty for all political prisoners and prisoners of war, which celebrated its anniversary through, oh my God, it wasn't just a conference. It was like two rallies, two marches, an evening concert, a series of meetings with the United Nations, and I think I'm missing stuff, but it was a weekend of resistance that really kept us without sleep for quite a lot of time. Just last weekend, both of those efforts spoke directly, indirectly, and in some cases very directly, to the internationalization of the struggle. And certainly the stuff that Jericho did at the United Nations does speak to an announcement I'm happy to make tonight that some of you know a little bit about already, but that essentially there is a Jericho International that is opening up, a new front of work, not new, but a new moment in work that's in some ways been going on for a while, but that hasn't had much organizational content for at least 10 years, where folks from different national liberation movements within the U.S. and, you know, white supporters from anarchist Black Cross, from within the anti-militarist movement and from the anti-imperialist movements, coming together to say, how do we bring the issue of political prisoners and through that the issue of national liberation within the U.S. to an international audience. And we've already gotten some close friends within the Latin American countries quickly coming on board to say we want to help. It does look like we are confirmed to have a meeting this weekend with the president and vice president of COSATU from South Africa. So looking at the internationalization of this work is right on the table. And the last thing I want to say, I opened by talking about the personal is political, and I always like to do book talks and book releases, at least reading something from the book, so I can say, ooh, that was a cool thing. I've got to buy it so I can read more. And they are, did someone mention they are for sale tonight? So I'm actually going to, I'm going to read something not that I wrote, but I'm going to read something that speaks eloquently, very eloquently, to the personal as political, and also speaks to me about this whole question, which also, you know, speaks about today, tonight in particular, about community, and about how our community and our neighborhood and our organizations and building comrade, you know, relationships is key to the work. This is actually from a speech that I heard live and was very inspired by at the time. It's a speech that happened right before the 1980 tribunal here in New York City, and it's a speech that was given by Theruba bin Wahad, who had just recently been released after 20 years in prison, 20 plus years imprisonment. This is what Theruba said. He was talking about the question of objectivity and subjectivity. Theruba said, "Our fight is essentially a work of the heart and spirit. I remember in the Black Panther Party, whenever a criticism was given to a brother or a sister, the first thing out of their mouths used to be, 'That's subjective, sister. That's subjective, brother. You have to be objective.' I used to sit back and reflect on that, and one day I was picking on Noah Washington in Greenhaven, and I said, 'You know something, Noah? Back in the days of the party, we used to always talk about how everything was subjective.' And Noah says, 'You're right. What we didn't realize then is that it was the subjective factor that was the dynamic factor. Before we could move ourselves, we have to change our hearts. And if we change our hearts, we can move other people, because the human heart is universal. The human spirit is universal. And those that do not want to move with us, we can leave them behind.'" Thanks for being here, folks. Thanks for being here. Before we get into some questions and answers, I guess I want to say it really is a labor of love, and it's really definitely not not as hard to be an editor as to be an author. And I guess I've been saying as my common line, editing a 914-page book is, in fact, not as hard as one might think. It just means you don't have to say no to anyone. But I will say part of the joy of my role is to try to bridge communities and bring people together. And in Seeds of New Hope, it was both to bring the academic and the activist community together, to bring scholars and students together, and to bring folks who we thought would be interested in general peace and nonviolence work to the same conversation with people involved in African liberation. And African liberation not just as it meant in decolonization terms 50 years ago, but in human liberation terms for the 21st century. As far as Let Freedom Ring, obviously, you know, a number of different communities, but I guess it's just worth saying after Lynn's remarks, we got the foreword from a Nobel Peace Prize winner, from Adolfo Perez Esquivel, himself a former political prisoner from Argentina, you know, a lifelong pacifist and coordinator of this Latin American-wide nonviolence movement, and someone who has written and signed documents for political prisoners in the U.S. for some years now, but one of a few people we're really trying to move to the fore to say, you know, there is this community of international, you know, pretty high-ranking and well-respected international figures who understand the importance of U.S. political prisoners. And the last word to say is I know you have to have won a Nobel Peace Prize in order to officially do this, but I think we should be working, and this is not our primary campaign, but maybe a secondary campaign, to certainly nominate and get Nobel Peace Prizes for Lynn Stewart and Ashanti Olsen.
That was
second.
I accept.
All right, Bobby, you want to start off with some comments. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say part of what made it such an honor and a privilege to be part of helping kind of reviewing the book and adding things here and there and helping with the biographies was that, you know, there's been a lot of pamphlets put out over the years about political prisoners, but very few full-length books. And particularly, what is so important about this book is, as Matt just said, it bridges all of the movements that currently have U.S. political prisoners, including a last-minute addition, thanks to former colleague of mine from WBAI, Reem Katkuda, who, when we raised her, when we got her permission to use her essay about the San Francisco 8, she said, well, is there anything about any of the Arab and Muslim prisoners, which prompted us to include a piece about Sami El-Aryan, and
who is now out.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Temporarily out.
Temporarily,
but
still,
still facing deportation. A Palestinian activist who's been bitterly persecuted by the feds. And then Reem and I together wrote an essay putting that in the context of 25 years of focused prosecution and persecution of Arabs and Muslims by the U.S. government. But also that this becomes a resource that can be, and I think folks should try to push it into libraries, because, I mean, it has these verdicts of tribunals, people's tribunals, several different ones about political prisoners, about Vieques, about indigenous people's suppression, about Mumia's case, that really lay out in a very comprehensive and legal but accessible to lay people style, all of the evidence as to every kind of international law and human rights that's been violated. And at the same time, through having the writings of more than 30 political prisoners directly themselves, and through the bio section and other parts of the book, descriptions that really humanize them, and to get back to Lynn's point about these are the heroes and heroines, really makes it very concrete about just what makes them heroes and heroines and what extraordinary people they are. I think that comes through loud and clear from anyone who even spends a little time. You don't have to read the book from cover to cover. And a special point that I was really thrilled about was that this is the first book-length discussion of political prisoners. It's really given a major role to the question of lesbians, gay, and bisexuals, and transgender, both those who are political prisoners or were, such as Kwesi Balogun and Laura Whitehorn and Linda Evans and Susan Rosenberg, and also the many folks in the outside community really organized through their networks, through our networks, some of us, to bring another front in the struggle to free the political prisoners. And last thing that I think is so inspiring about this is it essentially covers 25 years of work to free political prisoners. And through the different essays and articles and petitions and what have you, you really get a sense of the campaigns and the tactics and the multiplicity of tactics and the creativity of tactics and strategies and, you know, the artistic work and the literary work and the agitational work and civil disobedience and all these different methods that, you know, we've seen most vividly in the case of the Puerto Ricans actually succeeded. 11 of them walked out the door of the prison in 1999 because this massive movement that had been built and used many, many tactics succeeded. So that's kind of a blueprint for the future that I think is worthy of study. Not just the Puerto Rican victories, but there's other victories that are documented in the pages of this book. So for multiple reasons, I just think it's a really important contribution to the literature on this, and hopefully everyone will try to get it out there widely.
The only reason Bob isn't a co-editor is that he can make remarks just like that, as it seems. Thank you, Bob. Betsy, I'm not sure why Betsy's name isn't on the cover, but that's another long story. Any comments or questions before we get into sort of informal?
Yeah, do you have like a website or a flyer or something? Like I'm going back to Maine.
I didn't make flyers here. There is a general flyer and I can certainly for both books, and I can certainly email them to you or to anyone. I guess I realize, and this is a 21st or 20th century way of thinking, we did not set up special websites for each of these books. I guess that's what you do these days. But they are prominently featured on the websites of the publishers.
Oh, okay.
Both publishers have given them quite a bit of space, all three publishers. So pmpress.org, okay. AfricaWorldBooks.com, both have them on their home pages and links to more information about them. And actually, Kersklebedeb, if you can learn how to spell that, does have a whole section on Let Freedom Ring that has some stuff that's nowhere else but on their site. How do you spell it? I'll be giving a course in that. Yes, you have to actually buy the book in order to learn how to spell it.
How do you spell it?
Yeah,
right.
All right.
Isn't it true
that they're related, but it's not the same. They're the same. They distribute it. Yes, Betsy?
Isn't it true that Kersklebedeb is going to have a list of political prisoner support groups as an active link?
No, actually, it's going to be on the JerichoMovement.com. They've agreed to maintain the resource list we assembled in this. At the end of the book, will be kept updated, and when there are new committees or changes, it will all be there.
Okay.
Other questions or comments? No. Okay, so you...
What's your next in there?
What's my... Yeah, I'm going to be sleeping.
This one, you ordered, let's say that you ordered it from Quebec?
Yeah. Okay. Probably best ordered from PM Press, which is San Francisco. I mean, the folks in Montreal have a certain number of copies, which they really take into Canada distribution, but PM Press in San Francisco is doing most of the U.S. And it's also easier to spell PMPress.org, much easier.
So how many were
printed? I don't know. Over 1,000. And
okay. I just wanted to know if there's a strategy for, now that the book is out, for organizing work around it, maybe another project.
It's interesting you should mention that. There are a lot of things. I mean, we had the initial book releases for Let Freedom Ring in California around the critical resistance stuff, and obviously there's no coincidence that many of us do work around the Jericho movement and see that as a nexus for some organizing, some future work. But there are a number of CD projects that we thought of that were attached to this. I mean, one of them, speaking of the youth, and I have to say, I'm definitely into this John Henry thing, but, I get to mention, because my name is on the cover, my daily inspirations about the next generation come from Michael Dell, who's being very, very patient and very, very sweet and very, very strong. It's not easy to be 8 and sit through all this, which is a little boring. But the other place I get inspiration from in terms of CD stuff, and Molly Sue, who's upstairs now, don't want to not mention her, but about a year and a half ago, as this book was coming to its closing phases, or as we were beginning to sort of wrap it up, about 6 of my high school students did a CD project of some current political prisoners, some former ones like Ashanti. The frame on that was the Black Panther Party and its relevance today. But it was a 2-hour radio spot they did, which is essentially unavailable anywhere. And we were thinking of combining that as a CD to go with it, as another way of presenting the stories. Because we had San Francisco 8 Voice, we had Jaleel do a radio thing. We couldn't do an audio spot, but Dilatula Shakur did some writing for the students. So it was a package very much like that, which we ended up not being able to, for fiscal reasons, bunch with this book. That doesn't mean that the way we do things, cottage industry, R&B, whatever, we will make that available in our grassroots work here, and other folks can. But I think there's no particular strategy. But the answer to the question is, I think there's no particular strategy. PM Press tends to be pretty good at getting things in different places. The PM Press, maybe people don't know it, is related to AK Press, so they're pretty good at getting things out there at conferences and getting ads and the right people. So I think I'm confident about that piece of it, but the rest we have to do. If there are no other questions or comments, I really strongly invite people, as they're purchasing books from Elsbeth, to eat all the tea that talk amongst yourselves and have some fun. There's no pizza.
Before, Matt, can we just announce the R&B and New York ABC are going to have a for us it's been an annual card riding party to the prisoners, and last year I think and the year before you joined us, and this year it's a combined effort. It's going to be on the 14th of December, and it will be at my place, which is 263 Eastern Parkway, and hopefully we'll have a palm card out about it. But put it in your books if possible. It'll be from 3 to approximately 6 on Sunday, the 14th of December. Every year, last year, I think we sent out approximately 96, 97 cards to the prisoners. And we make them, we attempt to make them first. It's a whole process. And everybody that's possible to sign them. And the letters we get back from the prisoners are really, really inspiring, and I think it means a lot to them.
So. And it's lots of fun. And we have good food.
Yeah.
ABC and R&B, we invite all the initials to come.